I are joined this week by Dana Rawls and Stephanie Zinnegar-Marr to talk about the Biden administration hitting the ground running this week. Ed Blakely is a former Washington insider now living in Sydney, Australia. My name is Sean Britton from the radio station 2SER. Find us this year wherever you find good podcasts, as well as on Facebook and Twitter at US of Ed. Dana, Steph, Ed and I had a chat about this last week while the inauguration was going on, but how were the two of you feeling last week with the inauguration and the swearing in of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris? Dana, I'll let you go first.
Oh my gosh, I was absolutely thrilled. I have been waiting for this moment for the last 2 months, like 81 million other Americans, and God knows how many other non-Americans have been waiting. Seeing Joe put his hand on the Bible and take the oath was incredible. But I have to say, I actually got a bit teary when Kamala took hers as well. It was just such an amazing moment. I could not have been more proud. And I personally felt when I saw Kamala and her husband and the Pences walk down the stairs together, really kind of keep that tradition of the transition of power. I thought that was a wonderful moment to see them all kind of sharing that laugh. Of course, this is supposed to be the outgoing president with the incoming president, but that didn't happen. But I was really glad to see Pence and his wife step up. And I just was so pleased with the entire event, particularly with Amanda Gorman, who was the poet.
Mm. Steph, how about yourself?
You know, I felt a sense of awe. And in light of everything that's happened over the past 3 weeks, even though it feels like such a longer time, January seems like it's gone forever. There was a real sense of awe and a sense of disbelief in some ways that the American democracy really is as solid as it appeared to be on Inauguration Day after everything that had happened in the lead up. So it was a big sense of pride, both from a, wow, this is actually democracy in action. It's prevailed, as Joe Biden said in his speech. You know, pride in America, you know, that sort of black girl magic pride where it was like, oh my goodness, she looks like me. And, you know, kind of that, you know, that feeling of joy, you know, relief. It was, I had a lot of feelings, you know, a lot of feelings that day, possibly because I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning to watch it unfold live. But, you know, I have to be honest, until they walked off stage, I was still holding my breath because there was still a little bit of fear about what might happen. But it was just such a mix of emotions, such a wonderful, beautiful day and a beautiful ceremony and just a lot of pride that democracy in America, at least for now, has prevailed.
The Biden agenda, I mean, we'll get to the Biden agenda in just a moment, but before we get to that, the agenda is only really going to be possible with Democratic Senate control. The great state of Georgia really came through with the Senate vote. This was after the state turned blue in the presidential election. Dana, I've really been wanting to hear from you on this one. What can you tell us about the turnout?
Oh my gosh. I have always been proud to be a Georgia peach, but I have never been more excited with those. I could not have been more thrilled with those results. We turned Georgia blue in terms of the presidential election and both. I was actually a bit concerned. I wasn't sure that Ossoff would pull it off, but both Senate seats went blue and I am just absolutely thrilled. My understanding is that Georgia, just like the rest of the country, had pretty historic turnout. There was incredible turnout among African-Americans, among Asian Americans, among women, among the poor. And of course, those demographics are generally what tend to power the Democratic Party. And so kind of unsurprisingly, that was a key element to Biden, Ossoff, and Warnock kind of sweeping. And of course, all praise goes to groups like Fair Fight that have been led by the incredible Stacey Abrams, Black Voters Matter, that's been led by Latasha Brown, Andrea Young at the ACLU of Georgia, and lots of other people that made the critical analysis that Georgia was not a red state, that Georgia was a voter suppressed state. That's Stacey Abrams' very wise words. and they made a point of getting people out to vote. And now we've seen firsthand what happens when people turn out the way that they should.
Let me add one thing there. There were some white people that voted, and they voted against Trump.
They sure did.
They may not have voted for those two candidates, but anything was better than a person that supported Trump.
That's right. And then when you see the attempts that he made in the state to try to overturn Biden's victory there, I mean, it's not really that surprising that so many people, even a lot of white conservatives, turned their backs on him. I mean, there's no question he still has a huge amount of conservative support in Georgia, as he does throughout the rest of the country. But I think it does say quite a bit that a lot of people voted Republican down the ballot in Georgia, but did not vote Republican at the top of the ticket.
Agreed.
I think it will be interesting to see what happens next, both for Donald Trump and the Republican Party. I mean, if Trump goes off and forms his own, I think he was calling it the Patriot Party or, you know, the Trump Party, whatever it's going to be, you know, how does that impact the rest of the Republican Party? And can the Republican Party then move forward being more traditional Republicans once they take, I guess, the Trump element out of the party, which hopefully they will, and hopefully there'll be a return to normalcy somewhat.
Remember, parties aren't monoliths. And the Democrats who support Trump and New Patriot Party might pull some of them. So you have to be a little bit careful for what you wish for. A new party like that might bring in all kinds of other people who have other agendas, not even supporting Trump. People out there who want to be in public life, as you can see, like Holly, will do anything to get there.
Absolutely. And I mean, Stephanie, I think your point is incredibly valid, that what happens to the Republicans next, because we're seeing in a lot of ways what's happening. The Republican Party, instead of analyzing the 2020 election results and saying, you know, we really need to expand our platform, we need to find a way to reach out to more people, instead, what is the lesson that they appear to have learned from 2020 is we need to find every conceivable way to restrict the number of people that are voting in the elections. You also have large numbers of Republicans that are still supporting Trump. The Arizona GOP party actually just censured Cindy McCain for endorsing Joe Biden. So I don't know where the Republican Party goes from here, but
right.
And Jeff Flake, yeah, and the governor of Arizona as well, and the Oregon GOP has also come out and put its full-throated support behind Trump. So I don't know where the Republicans end up, but from where it's looking right now, it doesn't seem as though they feel that they need to change anything.
Stacey Abrams, incredible effort, incredible result, but what does the result mean for the South as a whole? Ed, I might turn to you on this one first. Are we going to see a return of Dixie Democrats or more and more a reflection of shifting demographics?
Well, first of all, the Dixie Democrats didn't go away. They became Republican. When Thurman became Republican, all the Dixie Democrats went his way. So they are not transmuting. They are just not knowing exactly how to pedal ahead. Because going ahead being just against black people is not enough. They have to have some new agenda. Now, they're all fighting to be on Trump's side, but what side is Trump on other than his own side? There's no policy position that he holds. There's no real thrust that he holds that differentiates him, except holding back others. That can't last. I think the South is going to be won for three reasons. One, the influx of immigrants. Asians, Hispanics, and others helped in Georgia, and they really helped in Arizona. The second reason is education. It's hard to have an agenda that is against people when you're educated. We've seen this with young people turning in their own parents from the insurrection. They're not buying it.
And for them.
And the third reason is, what are you for? The Democrats are for a lot of things like climate change. So I think that as places get smarter, they get what looks like Democratic. But it's really progressives. Progressive is the right word. The Democrat may be the progressive, but in some places in the Northeast, the Republicans are progressive, like in Massachusetts. So I think we may see some morphing of the parties, where the progressives we call Democrats. Unfortunately, that's not happening here in Australia, where the upper hand is held by the Liberal Party, because the Labor Party, our Democrats, still hold themselves to the unions. And in the U.S., that long swing through Clinton has moved the unions to be more progressive. So I think we're going to have a different kind of people. Same church, different pews.
And just before we get off Georgia, Dana, there's an online event you're involved in organizing right now, a love letter to black voters in celebration of the historic turnout in the 2020 election. What can you tell us about that?
Oh, I'm happy to talk about that. Democrats Abroad, of which Stephanie and I, of course, are members, and we are also the chair and the co-chair of the Global Black Caucus here in Australia. We will be organizing an event in February where we will be discussing a lot of the issues that we're touching on right now, which is the role of the black vote, voter suppression, election integrity, all of these hot button issues that have really come to the fore in the States. And we are going to be celebrating black voter turnout, which was absolutely unprecedented in the last election. Black voters really came through. To be completely honest, all voters coming through. I mean, turnout was up across the board. But speaking as a Black American woman myself, I mean, I know personally, I have family members, I have good friends that just don't vote. They don't see the point. And this has been an issue in the Black community forever, is getting people out to the polls. So I think we should be celebrating this. We're going to have Andrea Young, who is the director, the executive director of the ACLU in Georgia. She is going to be coming on board to talk about how integral the Black vote was in the 2020 general election and in the 2021 general, in the special election in Georgia. We're going to have all of that information up on our Facebook page as soon as we finalize everything.
Fantastic.
Fabulous. We'll try and include some information on that on the podcast as well. Just moving on to the cabinet at the moment, the cabinet makeup. Ed, you and I have spoken at length about a lot of the individual picks for the cabinet positions in the lead up to the Biden inauguration. Are there any additions for us to keep our eyes on at the moment?
Well, I think the first thing, and this may seem strange for me to say this, to have a Native American the head of the Department of Interior. This is really unprecedented for a Native American woman to be head of that department, because the Department of Interior runs what they call Indian Affairs. And those of Americans are ashamed of what goes on in our reservations. And having someone from that culture who can help break that, the backbone of that poor system, will be enormous. Like here in Australia, having an Aboriginal gives you a step toward, as Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, gives you a step toward the right direction. We haven't had that necessarily, but I think you've got to be in the job in order to change things there. The other picks are old boys. They're old boys from Obama. I'm all for that. I'm one of those old boys too. The culture from the Clinton Obama era was competence. You know, I used to walk in the White House and the desk was empty, and I said, "Well, what are some?" They couldn't do it. They couldn't cut it. They let them go. And have competence rather than loyalty. And that's what Joe said. Competence is going to be the key. There is no one on this cabinet except Yellen, who is well known, whose name could go on the dollar bill, but they all are competent.
Exactly.
And they reflect America.
I think that's probably the most exciting part, is that it is probably one of the most inclusive cabinet that we've ever had. It really is reflective of what America looks like today and who we are or who America is moving towards.
That's what the Proud Boys said.
I don't think that's quite what the Proud Boys said.
They are really mad now.
Oh, but you've seen that they have tried to kind of stake a claim here in Australia as well. It is astonishing how quickly things can kind of move now.
Look, we seem to imitate all the bad stuff that goes on in the U.S.
Absolutely.
We have a hard time getting to the good stuff, but maybe we'll get there.
One actually holdover from the Obama era that I wanted to talk about, we haven't spoken about yet, was Merrick Garland. I mean, he was nominated by Obama for the Supreme Court, left vacant, of course, by Antonin Scalia. And then we all know how that one turned out, with obstruction. Ed, what are your feelings on him for Attorney General?
I think he was put there as a symbol of justice. He's not an administrator, and Justice Department certainly needs that. And he'll find someone who can run the department. But both the Republicans and Democrats respect him and all the judges as a judicial mind. And when he issues an opinion, it's not going to be off the back of an envelope. He is a genuine scholar, and he was needed. We didn't know we'd win Georgia, but who's going to oppose Garland to be Attorney General? And that's now the most important department in the United States, because all the theft and corruption that went on in the last administration is going to be uncovered.
Absolutely.
And people can't say, oh, this is just a shield of the president. And even if Joe Biden's son is on that list, Joe's going to go with it.
Mm. Stephanie, we've been hearing a lot about Kamala Harris taking a much more active role as vice president, given, for one, Biden's age, but also the situation we now see in the Senate. What role do you envision for Harris?
Look, I really hope that it's a stepping stone for her. If Biden chooses not to run again in 3 years, whether it's due to age or some other reason, I hope she then is able to step into the role of president of the United States. And I think, you know, she's kind of positioning herself that maybe it's becoming more and more possible in the minds of a lot of people to consider a female president, a president of color. You know, all of these things, it's kind of about a gradual transition from she's not president now, but you can see her stepping into the role. And I think that that's probably, if nothing else, if Joe Biden does nothing else for the next 4 years, that is probably going to be his biggest contribution.
After COVID.
After he solves COVID, after he fixes domestic terrorism. But the fact that he's put her into the role as vice president for little girls, for Kamala Harris, for everyone in the world to see that a Black woman can do the job. Joe Biden will be my favorite president from here on out.
I want to say one of the things that, and I'm sure it's going to happen, she doesn't have a substantive role yet. Mm. She's standing there while he gives the speech. And I think that's fine, but at some point she has to make an announcement. And I don't know when that'll be, because she has that capacity. If you saw her in Senate hearings, she is, wow.
She is brilliant.
Brilliant.
Yes.
It's only been a week, though. Give them time, you know?
Well, but look, my expectations are pretty high.
I can tell, but I don't think that, you know, there's no question she has an absolutely transformative role right now, because she is basically the tiebreaker. I mean, she has such an important role in the Senate. I mean, this is what everyone is saying, that this is going to be Kamala Harris's legacy, even more so than being vice president.
Agreed. And Mitch McConnell caved because of that.
Mm.
Absolutely. He doesn't want to be the person standing up to the first Black Southeast Asian female vice president and standing in the way of the efforts from this administration to kind of change things, particularly as it pertains to COVID. I mean, the optics of that would look bad enough that even someone who is as callous as Mitch McConnell, even he would have to kind of step back from that and go, I don't want to be that guy who is seen, you know, I'm happy to have obstructed President Obama every step of the way. But I think maybe even Mitch McConnell might have some limits. I don't know. Maybe I'm giving him a bit too much credit.
I think you are. But there is another thing here, and that is we know Biden's agenda, but it doesn't cover everything. And I want her to start taking on some of those roles in social policy.
Okay.
And other things that would give her a clear mandate. Mm-hmm. She's certainly a great congresswoman. She's proven that. People can run those tapes. But let's see her do some other things. I mean, we've got disasters like that Flint water thing that hasn't been really cured. Mm. We got Flints all over the place.
Exactly.
And she could be the person that takes the underbelly of social justice and not above racial. Because she comes from a background like that. She comes from the hood in Oakland. And I know that place because that's where I'm from.
Those of us from the hood have to represent. I'm from Atlanta, which, you know, can be a bit hoodie.
Yeah, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, she, I know exactly
she feels
what you're
it.
And I love that Joe Biden is actually making executive orders about race.
Yes.
He is one of the few presidents. He might even be the first.
No, Truman was the
first. Actually even discussed white supremacist terrorism. Mm. I mean, this is revolutionary. And I think that it's because of this. Again, I'm probably giving Mitch McConnell too much credit. I think that the optics would look so bad. We've got Joe Biden, who's really making a concerted effort right now to address these issues that were shown so spectacularly on January 6th. And Kamala Harris, who just by virtue of being there, represents progress, represents the future.
Yes.
And I would like to think, and I, again, I'm happy to concede if I'm giving him too much credit. I would like to think that even cynical, you know, Mitch McConnell looked at that and said, I don't want to be the person who's standing in the way of this. But for whatever reason, I'm glad that he caved. I'm glad that Chuck Schumer is realizing that he has the keys now and that they're going to operate that way.
Agreed.
I do think that there's something to be said. You know, Biden has made clear his four priorities. And I think the country is in such a state right now that maybe even four priorities is a lot to focus on, but there's sort of four crises that are happening that not that, you know, the Flints of the world aren't important, but let's fix Corona first. Let's fix.
No, agreed. Agreed. I mean, there's stuff out there that she can take on. That's all I'm saying. He doesn't have to take on all four.
Look, just looking at the agenda and the way it's sort of been focused on in the first week of the Biden presidency, we know that Biden has this mask order in place and he's stepped up the vaccine rollout. It remains to be seen how successful these will be, but they're taking steps. I want to talk more about the economic assistance. One interesting one this week, an executive order ordering the Department of Labor to issue guidance that workers have a federally guaranteed right to refuse employment that will jeopardize their health, and if they do so, they will still qualify for unemployment insurance. Ed, look, I'll ask you first, how significant do you find this one?
The Republicans would not do that.
Mm.
That's all I have to say. That's all I have to say. Capital should never conquer people. And that's all Joe's saying. It's not the money. It's the human. And he can say this because he has been through a lot. And I think it comes through. And those are the kind of voters the Democrats are going to get in the future. Some of whom were Trump voters. But if this $1.9 trillion comes through and we all get those checks in the mail and grandma gets taken care of and shops start opening and stuff, it's over.
Exactly.
Well, Dana and Steph, I mean, these are most definitely, there would have been some of these voters that that you guys were reaching out towards. The employment system or the unemployment system in the United States, I think it's fair to say, it's a bit of a mess, and it's really made things difficult for a lot of Americans during this pandemic. Are there opportunities for reform that now are on the table?
I think there has to be. In the U.S., from what it was 12 months ago to what it will be in 12 to 24 months, it won't be the same country. It can't be, because it's been proven throughout the whole COVID crisis, which is still ongoing. I mean, 4,000 people are dying every day. 400,000 Americans have died so far in a year. You know, the country's going to go through a metamorphosis. And I think, you know, whether it's employment, whether it's the economy, whether it's who is essential and who isn't, Americans are going to have to rethink a lot of what they believe and a lot of the ways that they live and that they take for granted or have taken for granted up until now.
Absolutely. I'd like
to add, I want to add something to this. I want an Andrew Yang to be Secretary of Labor.
Okay.
Because guaranteed, progressive, guaranteed income. He believes in workfare. I think unemployment ought to be scrapped altogether, and that people should get, as they're getting COVID relief, particularly while this pandemic is going on, they should get ordinary relief if they're under $75,000, as we do with JobKeeper. And I also think a guaranteed income should be brought in, as well as $15. Is it enough? It should be $20 an hour. Should be brought in. People are going to still go to work. If we got that and genuinely good health care, it's over, Red Rover.
That's right.
Immigration, we saw executive orders on ending construction of Trump's wall, ending the Muslim ban, and reaffirming the Dreamers program right off the bat. But it's kind of difficult to work on getting people into the country and locking down COVID at the same time. Do we see an agenda emerging on immigration?
Well, I'll let you talk about this, Stephanie, a bit. But I think the Republicans first wanted the immigration bill. They started this back in the Obama era. We need a clear immigration bill. Every time it came up, every time it was brought up, Mitch would not reach the floor because a comprehensive immigration bill was not the best interest in big capital. Big capital wanted to bring in the people they wanted under various rules and regulations and so on. And some of the now Trump people thought the people coming in from the bottom are taking their jobs. So a good clean bill would just get rid of that. I like the Republican bill. It was a good bill. Now, what are they going to do now? Say they're against it? Was it 7 years to citizenship? That makes sense for everybody. If you can keep your record clean, you've been doing a good job, have recommendations, and can pass the test in whatever language they put it in. Let people in. You know, the thing that makes people crazy is you don't know the rules.
And that's what it seems like to me. I mean, I'm hearing you say you like the bill, but from where I've been sitting, the past couple of years, the Republicans' focus on immigration just seemed to be scaring Americans half to death into thinking that these caravans of immigrants and migrants were coming to steal their jobs and kill their kids in the middle of the night. I've not heard anything that speaks in any way to a comprehensive immigration policy. The only thing the Republicans talked about were the caravans and building the wall.
And that's so. But there was a very good Republican bill. It started way back in Bush. Would have done all the things I talked about. The Democrats were against some aspects of it. But basically, that's the bill that's going to be brought back up.
Well, I was just going to add that I think that what we're seeing with the Biden administration and outside of sort of the COVID era, COVID time, is really a turning away from xenophobia. Mm-hmm. All the hallmarks of sort of the immigration policy or immigration debate over the last few years has all been based around fear and the fear of those people are coming here, they're bad, we're good. Biden is saying wants to unite everyone. So he's removing that xenophobic aspect. He's taking away that policy of fear of the other, whoever the other is.
Yeah, I believe those caravans were back on the move the moment the Biden inauguration.
Oh, I'm sure they are.
But, you know, I didn't like the way the candidate for Homeland Security handled it. He says, we'll process them when they get here. That's not the way to handle it. Say, look, first of all, there are only 8,000 of them. All right, we usually get that many a day. So our first thing should be to help Latin America and Central America stem that tide by good economies and dealing with COVID. So when we get our COVID medicine, we're going to send some of that to them. That'll mm-hmm. keep them home. Next, we'll help Mexico defend its own borders. Next, we will provide a policy, as we do for the rest of the world. You have to go to the American embassy before you can come to the border.
And one that follows on from this one.
Or an American consulate. And what will happen with that is people in Central America will be treated like everybody else.
Wouldn't that be nice?
There are probably some structural and systemic factors at play as well.
But I'm not talking about refugees. I'm talking about people who are seeking work and citizenship. Some of the people are refugees from the war. Yeah,
The caravan, are they people who are just, I think we'll just travel to the States for work. Let's see what happens. Or are they fleeing?
Many of those are refugees, and he could have made that point. But people who are looking for work should go through the same system that all of us have to go through. You have to appear at an American embassy,
One that follows on from this that we were talking about before is Biden's inherited this huge reckoning on racial justice in the Black Lives Matter movement. Look, there's been a lot made, as you mentioned before, Stephanie, about the representation in Biden's cabinet. But what are some of the real practical agenda items that a Biden administration can push to see some positive movement in this area, in racial justice?
I think that there are a lot of systemic inequalities that exist in the U.S. and even starting to chip away at them would mean tremendous progress for people, especially people of color, Black people. And I think you really have to look at, is it, the cost of education? Is it the, housing inequality? There's so many different big, police violence. There's so many things that need to be fixed that I think even just starting with the baby steps, the small steps, will eventually lead to the big changes that need to be made. And I think, he's not just the Black community, but, by appointing, the first trans person to serve at an almost cabinet level position, to appoint the first open, maybe not the first openly gay, but, Mayor Pete, who is certainly, in a, gay
first
marriage.
Cabinet secretary. Mm. We've had ambassadors, but nothing else.
And years ago, we were arguing about whether bakeries could refuse to make cakes for gay weddings. And now we have, a cabinet level person who is openly gay. I think that to me is progress. And I think in terms of, the Black Lives Matter agenda and the Black Lives Matter movement, we need to identify what are the big goals. The big goals would be for police to stop killing Black people. How do we fix that overnight? I think that will be hopefully something that they're working on, and hopefully they have more answers than I do, because I don't know how to stop it and how to change it overnight.
And it's such a huge issue. It's massive. It's never ending. It's all encompassing. But I know personally for myself, I would like to see a lot more focus on gerrymandering. A lot of people of color that do vote, their votes have been diluted. They've been negated because of the way districts have been established. So when you go to vote, but your vote is minimized or basically, allowed to be negated because the district has been created in such a way that, we'll put the Black voters over there and everybody else is over here. Your issues don't get addressed, and they certainly don't get addressed to a way that really speaks to how they affect those communities of color. So I know defund the police has been a huge issue, and there's a lot of discussion about that, particularly the name itself seems to have to bring up a really negative response in people, even though it seems to me, my understanding is that it's just about finding different ways of funding law enforcement and mental health services so that they're a bit more comparable. But for me personally, I think gerrymandering and really focusing on how districts are drawn up in the states is a huge issue. And I don't see that there's going to be a lot of relief for minorities until districts are done in a way that is more equitable and more fair.
Well, what were Trump's suits about? His suits were about black voters in catchments, right? Now, had voting rights been equal across the country, who would he sue? See, Trump didn't want black votes, but it's easy to target them because they were gerrymandered.
Exactly.
I'm going to put this out to you guys. Why not make voting mandatory?
And I love it.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with it being mandatory, but I think Election Day should be a public holiday.
I love that too.
I love that.
All the other things they can, that, you know, your one job on this public holiday is to go and vote. You don't have to go to work. You don't have to go to school. You don't have to go take out your, you know, go vote.
Well, I want people to be voters like you do in California. You get your driver's license, you get your registration at the same time. Mm. Motor voter. If you get a driver's license, you got a registration.
That's right.
Can't be any about your signature or anything, because your driver's license is your voter registration in the state of California.
I love it. I fully support making it mandatory. I fully support it making it a public holiday. I feel like if voting was mandatory, if we were to eliminate the Electoral College and if we were to provide statehood to Washington, D.C.
No, you're going too far.
Oh, come on. Are you kidding me?
Voting.
If we did these three things, my gosh, the numbers of people, we would be seeing the types of numbers that we saw in 2020 every 2 years. It would be, I think we would really be able to reach and tap into these people that are so disaffected that they don't see any point to it.
No,
you take these kinds of steps, and I think we will see the floodgates open, and I also think we would significantly reduce the chances of ever having another Republican president, which would be, in my opinion, kind of icing on the cake.
But I think we would increase the likelihood of a Kanye West becoming president, because just because people have to vote doesn't mean that they make good choices.
I'll move away from a requirement to vote, but I like the motor voter. If you can go to war, you can go to the polls. As soon as you get your first thing, that's your driver's license, you get your registration to vote.
100%.
It should be one and the same. And I'll go along with D.C. being a state.
Thank you, Ed.
And the reason for that, I lived in D.C. You know what the license plate is. You know, Stephanie.
Representation.
Born and raised in D.C., lived there until I went off to college. My mother still lives there. You pay taxes in D.C. You don't have a voting member of Congress.
No.
Absolutely insane.
With Puerto Rico, I have some qualms, and it's not about whether Republican or Democratic. They have not been enjoyed kind of the traditions that we've enjoyed in the states. Having a government there that is honest and freely elected is something that just almost never happens. It operates in a Caribbean culture, not in an American culture. Hawaii, this was the problem. Alaska, that wasn't the problem. But I've worked there a lot. And working in Cuba, I feel more secure about what's going to happen than in Puerto Rico.
Wow.
In terms of the political behavior. So I think we shouldn't jump to... I think people, D.C. is a totally different thing. It's like making Connecticut a state, you know?
Exactly.
But Puerto Rico, I have some problems. But maybe there may be other, I'd like to hear the other side of that argument, though.
Yeah. My issue with Puerto Rico is that Puerto Rico, the people of Puerto Rico have not seemed to make that decision themselves. And I don't think it's something that should be foisted upon them. Whereas no, D.C., they are very open. Like you said, Ed and Stephanie, it's on the license plate, tax agent. I lived in D.C. for 4 years and I remember seeing those license plates. So D.C. has been very vocal about having statehood, and there is absolutely no reason that I can think of that they should not be allowed to have that.
No, and they're institutionally like the United States, where Puerto Rico isn't.
Ed and I will be back next week to talk the latest in U.S. news and politics. And keep your eyes open, because we will have no doubt more specials coming to you with perhaps more guests over the course of this year. Subscribe so you don't miss a thing wherever you might find the podcast, and check us out on Facebook and Twitter at US of Ed.